Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
It's hard to believe, but over 60 years ago, the tale of two current NFL franchises began in one city in a battle for that city. Author John Heisenberg has told that story in his book, 10 Gallon Wars, and he's here to tell us about it in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron, one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. We are here once again to talk about some great football, professional football level today, and a very interesting book that was written by author John Heisenberg, one of his multiple books on the game of football. It's called 10 Gallon War, the NFL's Cowboys and the AFL's Texans, and the Feud for Dallas's Pro Football Future. We'll bring him in right now. John Heisenberg, welcome to the Pigpen.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
I am too, because this is a very interesting topic. But before we get into your book, maybe you could just tell the listening audience a little bit about yourself and what brought on your football fandom.
Well, I grew up, I'm a native Texan. I grew up in Dallas, born and raised in Dallas as a Cowboy fan. You know, I always tell people, you know, don't throw stuff at me too hard. But, you know, I came by it naturally. I grew up there. Family had season tickets from literally when the Cowboys began in 1960. So I'm a real one.
Wow.
After college, you know, I got into sports writing as a career. And I actually worked in Dallas for 5 years there at the afternoon paper there, Dallas Times Herald. I did not cover pro football. You know, I did cover a lot of Cowboy games and all that stuff. And then in 1984, I made a big move to the Baltimore Sun, where I got a column. I was a columnist at the Baltimore Sun for 25 years. So I did a ton of pro football there. But I got there right when the Colts were leaving. And so there was over a decade without football in Baltimore, and did a lot of Super Bowls and other cities teams and all that stuff. And then of course the Ravens came to town, and I've been covering the Ravens ever since. And as a matter of fact, since 2012, that's where I write. I left the newspaper business a little over a decade ago, cause I've written these other books. I had that sort of secondary career, but yet the Ravens actually bought me lock, stock and barrel, you know, my opinions. They want me to write opinion on their digital platforms, good, bad, or indifferent. It's been very interesting. But I've been doing that for a decade. So, you know, I've just been an opinion maker in the Baltimore market for many, many years and been around a million football teams and players and games. And, you know, aside from my daily stuff, I've done, as you mentioned, a bunch of books.
This is going to be a very interesting dynamic in our conversation, because I don't know if you know, I'm from Western Pennsylvania, lifelong resident, a Steelers fan. So I'm talking to somebody from Dallas who's born a Cowboys fan, who is sort of, I grew up with that nemesis of, you know, the three Super Bowls played against each other. And now the Ravens, the arch enemies of the Steelers. This is going to be really interesting. So this is get some great perspective here from you.
So I would like to be your the worst possible guest.
No, absolutely not. Because it's great when you can agree to disagree on things, and that makes conversations more interesting, I think. So this will, I think this will be extremely interesting. So we'll have to talk a little bit about Ravens Steelers if we have some time at the end. Now, let's get into your book. And your one book that in particular we want to talk about today is from your hometown, the Dallas Cowboys in pro football. And maybe if you could start off on, you know, sort of where the beginnings of pro football in Dallas was and what the climate was of that city for pro football.
Well, what's amazing was in the late 50s, there's no teams there. The Dallas, you know, now such a huge football market, is not one of those original markets where there was NFL teams like Pittsburgh and other places going back to the Depression and whatnot. But by the late 50s, of course, pro football was taking off. And there were a lot of cities that wanted in, most of them in the Southwest, you know, the Sun Belt, where there was starting to be some money. And certainly in Texas, there was a ton of money, oil money. And these cities wanted into pro football, but the NFL was reluctant to expand. George Halas and those guys and Art Rooney in Pittsburgh, they'd spent a lot of years not making any money. They were finally making money and they were hesitant to carve up the pie, really is what it comes down to. And they trusted each other, but they weren't sure who else they should trust. So they didn't want these cities to come in. So, you know, Lamar Hunt is a 26-year-old kid in Dallas native. He's the son of probably the wealthiest man in America. His father was H.L. Hunt, an oil man. H.L. assumed, actually, that Lamar would go into the oil business. But Lamar was a sports nut, and he was from the beginning. He was a football player. He was a third string end at SMU in the 50s. And he didn't want to go into the oil business. He wanted to go into football, and he wanted to go into the NFL. But those guys basically patted him on the head. Allison said, you know, we like you, we like your money, but we're not going to bring a team to Dallas. And so he made the decision, you know, that's what led him to form the AFL, was that the NFL wouldn't let him in. And so that's sort of where it all started. Honestly, the roots of the whole AFL and the changes in pro football and everything that came out of that, it started because Dallas had no teams and Lamar Hunt wanted one and didn't get one. So that's really where it all began.
But I didn't realize that Lamar Hunt was so young when he started his endeavor. That's really having some brass tacks at 26 years old. I don't know if I'd be thinking that big when I was 26 years old. Don't know about you, but that's really quite an endeavor to go to the NFL, even though it was a little bit smaller than it is now, and then start your own league when they don't accept you. That's a tremendous drive that he had to do that.
I think he was kind of naive, to be honest with you. I think he was not super competitive about it. He originally thought, well, they won't let me in. He was a very kind-hearted guy. And he was like, they're not going to let me in, so I'll just do my own league. Maybe we don't even have to compete with them. He was really naive in that. He was like, well, there's room for another league. We'll just have another league. And not realizing, of course, that the NFL people just freaked out when, you know, the possibility of another league. But I think when he started, he was like, oh, well, this will be fine. This will be great. We won't bother them and they won't bother me. Honestly, incredibly naive.
Yeah, I guess so. He probably didn't look back a decade earlier at the AAFC when they competed and ended up getting absorbed pretty much and had franchises eliminated when they were merged in the NFL. So not a great track record for rival leagues against the NFL.
Oh, no. Well, the NFL cared. They cared a lot about who the rivals were and, you know, very quickly realized we're getting a little ahead of it. But the people that he brought in, they had some money. The AFL people, Lamar, of course, had more money than all the NFL people put together. And so did Bud Adams, who started the Houston Oilers. And, you know, they had a lot of, not all of them, but they had a lot of people with money. And so right off the bat, the NFL said, woo, this is a real challenge. And so that's where things got started.
Okay. Now, you also say in your book that there was another franchise that was trying to be started in Dallas about the same time. Maybe if you could talk about that group or owner and the team.
What are you referring to? I mean, there was an NFL team in Dallas in the early 50s. You know, there was, you know, there was that team, the Dallas Texans.
Not the original Dallas Texans, but the start of the Cowboys franchise.
Oh, that. Yes. Well,
yeah, I didn't want to spill the beans too early on it.
Oh, that other team. Yes. Well, yeah, Clint Murchison was the oil man that eventually started the Cowboys, and he had been in touch with the NFL as well in the late 50s, before there was a team and the NFL was reluctant to expand, but sort of talking about it. He had been in touch with Halas and Rooney, and those old guys all knew him, and those guys all loved him. He was also from the oil business. He was this little, wisecracking, bespectacled guy. He was on the cover of Time magazine at one point. Really, really rich. The NFL guys loved his money, and he was funny, and they liked him. So they had not decided to give him a team yet. But when he'd been in touch with them, they all knew him. And then when the AFL started, and Lamar said, "We're starting this new league, and we're going to put a team in Dallas," the NFL, they didn't want to lose that market. They didn't want to lose the Dallas market and just hand it over. So they said, "Okay, well, we're going to put a team in there too." And they nominated, or they basically gave Clint Murchison a phone call and said, "Hey, are you ready to go?" That's really what it boiled down to. And he said, "Great." So they expanded. The NFL had not expanded in years. And they expanded with a team in Dallas in 1960. And then they paired it with the Minnesota Vikings, started in 1961. So they paired it with, you know, two teams they brought in. But they started the Cowboys almost with the snap of a finger. They said, you know, it was 1959, and the AFL was getting ready to start. And they said, "Hey, well, can you get a team up and running next year?" And Clint Murchison said, "Well, yeah, we can." And so it really was almost a quickie. You know, they said, "Can we get this thing going?" And they did. But Clint Murchison is the guy that got it going. And he was a good businessman, and he made a couple of key hires, I would say, given the history of what unfolded after that. He hired Tex Schramm as the general manager, who had been with the Rams and had been with CBS TV and was a real sort of forward thinking guy. And he hired Tom Landry as the coach, a Texan, from University of Texas, and, flew bomber missions in World War II, and was a successful, he was the defensive coordinator of the New York Giants at the time, a very successful, smart coach, assistant coach. Vince Lombardi was the offensive coordinator, a decent staff. And so he hired Tom Landry. So Clint Murchison did some very smart things. He hired some really, really good people. And so that was how the Cowboys began.
Yeah, very interesting. A couple comments here. I think when you talked about Minnesota, I believe the NFL did a similar thing with Minnesota. The AFL was about ready to open up a franchise there, and they contacted some folks up there, and poof, the Vikings came in. And I think that's what led the Minnesota franchise turned into Oakland, I believe. That's how the story went.
Yeah, that is correct. That is exactly what happened. And they were forcing hands. The NFL said, we're not going to give these markets up. It was contentious pretty quickly.
Now, in your opinion, had Lamar Hunt, they turned Lamar Hunt down. He decides, okay, I'm going to start my own league, get some of the other wealthy owners together to start this. Do you think if he hadn't done that and Murchison comes to them and says, "Hey, I want a Dallas Cowboys," that they would have sort of blown him off like they did Hunt at the first time?
Very debatable. It's a great question that we'll never know the answer to. They, as I said, they're in no hurry to expand. They had 12 teams through the whole 50s. They were very happy with that. The money was rolling in, as I said, from TV for the first time. And so they were making some money. They were excited about that because they hadn't made it for 30 years. And so they may not have, but, Congress was sniffing around. The pressure was coming, in terms of, being forced to expand. And I think they probably would have eventually. The expansion committee in the NFL was George Halas. He was the expansion committee. They claimed to have one. It was George Halas. He was running things. And so he really had no interest, but I think he could see, and Burt Bell, who was the commissioner, that it was probably going to have to happen pretty soon. There were just so many cities that were on the outside looking in that, it was almost a trust that needed to be busted.
Okay. So now we're at the point where Hunt has his team, which he ended up calling the Dallas Texans, the second incarnation of the Dallas Texans we alluded to earlier. There was an earlier team in the NFL that was the Dallas Texans. And you have, the Tex Ram hire, the Landry hire of the Dallas Cowboys are going with the other crew that had the NFL franchise. So how did those competing teams and leagues in the same market, how did they deal with each other?
Well, it was pretty crazy. Just such an unprecedented situation. There was one stadium, the Cotton Bowl, the big stadium, which was a real sort of college football shrine. They had a New Year's Bowl game there. Big stadium, big concrete sort of terrain with that had been the site of many, many great games. Texas and Oklahoma played there every year. I mean, Texas was a college football haven. That's why they wanted. I mean, it was very popular there, high school football, college football. The pros were, that's what they were trying to tap into, a real passionate football area, which it was then and still is. But once they got going, they fought over dates in the Cotton Bowl. Lamar Hunt had signed a lease. And so he got the Sunday afternoon window, a number of games that he could choose from, number of dates. So the Cowboys actually were sort of left out on that. And they started out playing I think their first ever game was on a Saturday night, and they had a Friday night game. And, the league wasn't telling teams what to do then. The national TV contracts hadn't started. So they were just winging it on these different times when they could play. So they fought over the stadium. They finally, when the other one played, when one team played, the other one was on the road, and people would decide in Dallas would decide which side are we going on here. Almost immediately, every football fan in Dallas had to decide: I can like both, but who's really my number one? And so certainly, for instance, my family. My grandfather, who was the purse strings with the tickets, and, he was sort of an establishment guy. So he's going with the NFL, that's for sure. The old established league, not the upstart. But, I had a cousin who was a young sort of hip guy, and he didn't want any part of that. And so he went with the AFL. He went with the Texans. So I think the way it broke down a little bit, I'm really overgeneralizing here, but maybe the older people went with the Cowboys, and the young people sort of liked the new upstart team, because right off the bat, the caliber of football, it was interesting. The Texans, who they hired Hank Stram, they also made a great hire for a coach, and they were playing good football from the get-go, and they were winning. They were pretty good. And the Cowboys were an expansion team, and the NFL were getting their brains beat in every week. So it was more fun to watch a team that was winning, so that helped the Texans. But the Cowboys, in Dallas, Texas, late 50s and early 60s was a minor league town at that point. And here come the Chicago Bears for a visit. That was pretty exciting. And New York Giants. And so they did do a lot of business at the gate with the teams coming in. I don't think the fans really cared about seeing the Oakland Raiders or whoever were brand new. But then Chicago Bears, now you're talking. And so they just sort of cut the city up in half and, tried their best. They papered the gates. Both teams wanted to draw more than the other. They gave away, Lamar Hunt in particular, gave away thousands of tickets. He just wanted bigger crowds than the Cowboys and did everything he could to do that. And so free, everybody gets in free practically. So there was just all sorts of shenanigans right from the very beginning.
Now, I think you allude to in your book, which I found to be very interesting in this dynamic, especially these first couple of years, that each franchise had its own marketing strategy and how to team building strategy. Maybe if you could go into that a little bit, maybe, what Hunt's philosophy, I know you're saying he gave away tickets and everything, but you had a little bit more fanfare with him, it seemed like.
With the AFL, for sure. And really it boils down to the AFL versus the NFL. The AFL played more wide open football. They were certainly at that point, and this is a whole another story, you know, we're a little more, you know, racially open-minded than the NFL. That was definitely happening in the AFL. And they tried to bring in local guys to be on the, you know, to lead the team, people that the college football fans may know. And yes, as I said, I mean, Lamar Hunt was a marketer. And so they tried everything. I mean, they shot off cannons with tickets, you know, they set off balloons over the city with the free tickets in them. And if, you know, it came down in your backyard, you got free tickets to the Texans game. If you went and got your car washed, they would give you a free ticket. They were just doing anything they could to get people to come. The Cowboys were more buttoned down, sort of traditional business, pay your ticket, come in, and we'll take our lumps at the gate because we know we're just starting out. But, you know, that actually, you understand that because the AFL was a new product. But Lamar was doing everything he could to get attention. You know, they brought in, you know, they hired 30 women, attractive women. Talk about something, you know, in the 2021 that would raise some eyes. They hired a team of attractive women to drive around in convertibles and give tickets away and attract attention, you know, the Texan girls or whatever they called them. I can't remember. And so I don't know how successful they were, but the good news for Lamar is he married one of them. So,
did you really?
Yeah. So that worked out well for him. The Cowboys were more traditional.
Okay. So we know that today we don't have two teams in Dallas. You know, we know that the AFL and the NFL eventually merged, and there's only one team in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that's playing major pro football. So what happened after that? One of the teams left. We obviously, the Cowboys are the team still there. What happened to the Texans?
Well, the Texans played three seasons there. They had winning teams. They drew some decent crowds. And their third season, they had a really good team. In 1962, they had Len Dawson as a quarterback. They had Abner Haynes, who is one of these guys that is just lost in the mists of history, was a great player in the early years of the AFL, a running back, could catch the ball out of the backfield, and, you know, won the rushing title. And they had a lot of nice players on their team. And they wound up getting into the championship game, the Dallas Texans, in 1962. And they played the Houston Oilers. So it was an all-Texas game, and this epic game unfolded. They were down in Houston, and, you know, they had a big lead, and then the Oilers came back on them. And this is a nationally televised game, and they wind up going into overtime. And it was a tremendous, the viewing audience was tremendous. In some respects, it was the day the AFL really was legitimized. You know, people talk about the Colts-Giants championship game in 1958 as sort of legitimizing the NFL. Well, the Texans-Oilers game in 1962 sort of legitimized the AFL. Goes into overtime, and this unbelievable scene unfolds where the Texans blow the coin flip to overtime. And the Oilers wind up with the ball and the wind, but nonetheless, they survived that and wound up winning the game in overtime. So the Dallas Texans are the AFL champions, and they fly home. The only bad news is Lamar Hunt knows he's already decided to move the team. He had decided this isn't going to work. This isn't going to work for me. I mean, we're sort of building things a little bit, and we're growing a little bit, but for the sake of this league, we need success stories, and we're in for a fight here. And he realized, and what's interesting is that Lamar and Clint Merkison were friends. They were in the oil business families, and they knew each other. Clint Merkison was going nowhere. The Cowboys were, they were from the established league. They had Tom Landry and Tex Schramm, and they might be losing right now, but they were building something, and they were going nowhere. They were not a fly-by-night operation, and Clint was loaded, so he could afford to lose money a little bit. So Lamar just made the decision, you know, and he founded the AFL. He said, we have to find somewhere where we can be a success. So he looked long and hard at New Orleans, It was really funny. He had friends in the oil business in New Orleans, and they told him, you can't do it here. There's too much money under the table in New Orleans. You can't go there. You the way they do business there, you won't do well. So he wound up going to Kansas City. And, you know, they gave him a sweet deal, a bunch of season tickets, a promise, and he was the only game in town. So he went there. So it broke his heart. I mean, that was his hometown. He never got over it. And the Chiefs, you know, they changed the name to the Can. I mean, some friends told him he was so heartbroken. You can call him the Kansas City Texans. And, you know, Lamar was a Texan, was halfway like, yeah, I might just do that. But, you know, they went, cooler heads prevailed, as they say. So they moved, you know, within weeks of winning the championship. The defending champions in the AFL in 1963 kicked off in a new city. And so 3 years and gone, and broke the hearts of their fans in Dallas. And to this day, it's an older group now, but you will find a small group of football fans, pro football fans in Dallas who hate the Cowboys. They hate them.
Really?
And,
wow.
Yes. And the reason is they were Texans fans. They loved the Dallas Texans. They loved the AFL, and they never got over it. They didn't get over it. It was, well, you know, our team left town. You moved my team out of town, and I'll never forget you for it. So it's a very small group, I might add. But
my mother lives in the Dallas area, and I just visited there this summer. Got to go see AT&T Stadium. I got my picture outside the Cotton Bowl. You know, did all the touristy football things. And I don't know. Everything where I looked, there was the silver star was everywhere.
Oh, so, yeah. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. I mean, you know, with Jerry Jones in charge, they've plastered it everywhere.
And I think that the souvenir store inside AT&T Stadium, a couple of days later, I was at the Pro Football Hall of Fame. The souvenir at the stadium for the just Cowboys paraphernalia is much larger than the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So by far, they have many more items in there, in my opinion, being there sort of back to back days. Now you said before the Lamar Hunt left and went to Kansas City, him and Murchison were friends. Do you think that they had some conversations in some back room somewhere over some adult beverages to sort of work things out?
Yeah, they may have. I'm sure they did have conversations. I think the possibility of them working things out was slim. You know, this was sort of an elite class of guys. I mean, financially. And they're sort of used to wheeling and dealing, and they have a lot of conversations about a lot of things, I think. So, yeah, they probably did talk about that. And, you know, I'm sure the NFL guys told Clint, listen, you know, if you could, especially before the AFL started, when it was clear there are going to be two teams, it's like, listen, can you bring Lamar in? Can you do this? Can you get him to, you know, call off the dogs? Can you do something with Lamar? We know you know him. And Clint said, well, yeah, I'm sure they probably had conversations then for sure. But once Lamar was a traditionalist and once he decided that we're going forward with this and he had partners, you know, he had these guys in these other cities, then there was no going back. I mean, he was down the road with, you know, Bud Adams and Ralph Wilson in Buffalo and, you know, Harry Wismer and those guys with the New York Jets and you know, Baron Hilton in San Diego, or what wound up being San Diego. The first year was the Chargers, LA. But now, ironically, they're back after all these years. But, right. You know, he had some partners. Clint might have talked to him about it, but he wasn't going to change his mind.
Now, I guess, I mean, it's a happy ending, win-win for both franchises, because things look pretty well for them. You're just less than a decade later, you know, Kansas City much earlier in the AFL, but even when they were both in the NFL, both having some championship runs. So it worked out very well. And I think Kansas City is very happy to have the Chiefs, especially nowadays.
Well, they got a great, yes. And but they got a great owner. I mean, Lamar Hunt is one of the great owners in sports, you know, and now his son's running it, but you know, Lamar was very fan friendly. He cared a lot about, you know, let's make it good for the fans. I mean, he, you know, they built those two stadiums in Kansas City. That was not the 1970 football, baseball, sort of, all of which had been blown up, you know, which didn't really work. He had sports specific stadiums. That was Lamar, wanting that. And yeah, I mean, so they got, he would walk the parking lot before games in Kansas City and talk to the fans. Are you okay? How are your seats? Are you happy? You know, he was just, you know, a humble guy that cared about the fans. And of course he loved other sports. I mean, I covered him at the beginning of my newspaper career in Dallas. He had owned a soccer team, and it was a team in Dallas, and I covered the team. And that's when I dealt with Lamar a lot. And if you had a question, you just called him. I mean, his phone was listed. You just call Lamar Hunt and his phone was listed. Wow. Yeah. You just call him. He'd answer the phone.
I assume Jerry Jones isn't the same way. He doesn't play his number public.
No, I don't think so. So
he'd never get off the phone, probably. That's
yeah. Sure. So they had a great owner in Kansas City. They were very happy with the way it worked out. And of course, what was really great and what I enjoyed writing about was the Chiefs won when they were going to start the Super Bowl that first year after the 66 season. The Chiefs win the AFL title, and the Cowboys host Green Bay in the NFL championship game at the Cotton Bowl. And, you know, we're one play away from forcing overtime, the Lombardi Packers in Super Bowl I. And really kind of old time Cowboy fan here, really kind of blew the game. I mean, they're on the 1 yard line and there was a moving penalty and they were going in for the tying score. And it probably would have been overtime. That would have been interesting to see Lombardi in overtime. But anyway, the Cowboys were almost there. It was almost the two franchises in the first Super Bowl. So, and as it turned out, you know, Super Bowl IV, then 3 years later, the Chiefs are back in it and they win. And then that is the last game between the AFL and NFL before the merger. The last game, the Kansas City Chiefs kicked the Minnesota Vikings up one side and down the other. You know, if you talk to these old AFL fans, one of the great days in history. And so Lamar, in some respects, got a last laugh with that. I mean, he lost his hometown and he never forgot it, but he had a lot of successes in his life.
Yeah, very, very interesting book. Maybe if you could let our listeners know where this book and your other books would be available for purchase so they can get some more of the details that you have in there, because it's truly a great book.
Well, this book, I wrote another one actually before it about growing up in Dallas as a Cowboy fan. It's really sort of an ode to being a kid in the 1960s, and it's called Cotton Bowl Days. That's one. And then 10 Gallon War. I also wrote a book about Vince Lombardi's first year with the Packers in 1959. The year that he took, I didn't write about the dynasty years, just all the changes that took place in that first year, which I found the story fascinating. And my most recent football book was one called The League, which is about, it's a league-wide story. It's about the early years of the NFL and how they barely made it. And I'm talking 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. And it focuses in on five owners who sort of just picked the league up by the collar and dragged it through these years. And Art Rooney in Pittsburgh is one of them. Burt Bell in Philadelphia. George Preston Marshall in Washington. And then, of course, Hallis with the Bears and Tim Mara, the original Mara, who started the New York Giants in 1925 for $500. So those are my football books, and they're all available on Amazon. You know, these are with major publishers. I've written over a period of years, and they're out there. You can get an audio version. You can get a paperback. You can get a hardback. Certainly on Amazon, anywhere, any major bookseller would be able to get these books for you.
I have a feeling my Prime account is going to be very active this weekend, making some purchases, and I'm sure most of our listeners will too, as when this airs. So, yeah, very interesting. I got to hear some about your book. You were on with one of my associates, Jeremy McFarland, I believe, not too long ago, talking about the book,
The League
on sports. The League, yeah. So, yeah. So, Very interesting.
The early days, the NFL. I'm fascinated with it. It's people just can't believe in this day and age that people, the NFL is so high and mighty and rich. That people can't believe that it was like a, you know, a little, you know, fly by night operation. And that's exactly what it was for many years. And so I really enjoyed researching that book.
Yep. It's really a fascinating story, especially, you know, I have my Steelers connection. I've done a lot on Steelers history and read a lot on Steelers history. And I've got a guest coming on here soon in the next couple of days, who is Alan March, who is Dr. March's great grandson that worked with Mara and developing the Giants and some of their stories. So there's some rich history there with those five teams. So, you know, very fascinating. Yes. So yes. I look forward to reading that book. Now, okay, now we got to get to the questions here. Now, you are your connection with the Ravens. Now, I know in less than a month from now, I believe, it's going to be the first Steelers-Ravens games. And I know what it is here in Western Pennsylvania and listening to the Pittsburgh media. When it's Ravens week, everything is focused on Ravens week. I don't, you know, the Pirates could be winning. The Penguins could be winning. It doesn't matter. It's Ravens week and the city is in a frenzy. And that's all everybody wants to talk about. Is that the same way it is in Baltimore?
Oh, very much so. It has been for many, many years. I will say, I think it's waned a little bit just because, you know, there's other teams out there and Kansas City Chiefs and there's a lot going on, but for sure, I mean, the Steelers are the number one rivalry by far. Everybody, they call it Steeler Week, you know.
Okay, so it's the same. Now, living in the 70s, I live in Erie, Pennsylvania, so I'm 100 miles from Buffalo, 100 miles from Pittsburgh, 100 miles from Cleveland. You know, three NFL franchises are doing pretty well here the last couple of years, anyway. Before the Ravens became the Ravens, they were the Browns, of course. And I don't remember even as a kid where Browns week was, you know, it was a rivalry and, you know, we had fun with it, especially, you know, it's sort of a mixed bag here in Erie with, you know, fans split between the three teams. But I don't ever remember it being like it is for a Ravens rivalry. I mean, these two teams just seem to, you know, bring out the best in each other. Probably the hardest hits you see in the highlight films of either team, It's always a Steelers Ravens games. It seems like, you know, you go back to the Hines Ward block, you go with, some of the linebacker hits on Roethlisberger, you know, where his nose is broken, his helmet's on sideways. It's a Ravens game. And I think those are just some of the fantastic games and probably one of the best rivalries in football going probably the last decade or so.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the AFC North was formed. When did they go to that? In 2002, I think.
I believe so.
They went to that. So, you know, before that, the Ravens were sort of battling with the Tennessee Titans in the old, what I can't remember what they called it.
The AFC Central was.
AFC before. Central. So, right. You know, the Ravens, I think, have been, and this is, I mean, I know this for a fact, they were a new franchise when they moved to Baltimore, even though Art Modell moved them. I mean, they started over with Ozzie Newsome and a lot of new people, and they really sort of modeled themselves after the Steelers because the Steelers, the way that they've operated with real staying the course with your personnel, hire the right people, keep with them, don't make changes all the time, you know, build through the draft, be patient. I really think especially when Steve Bisciotti became the owner, it's almost like they, you know, took a thing, put it up on a bulletin board and said, here's what we're shooting for. Right here. Okay. We're going to operate this way. And it was how the Steelers operated. And so the fact that they were in the same division was interesting. And so they sort of built themselves that way. And it helped organically. They had, you know, they drafted these great defensive players, Ray Lewis and all these guys. So they had a tough physical team. So they sort of modeled themselves after that. And then when they caught up to some degree, then you just had two really good teams just battling. And I think that's what fans, you could identify with that rivalry. You know, they were going to hit each other and it was just football. It was classic football. You know, it's what fans want from football. And so that's what made it such a good rivalry. And a lot of the old Ravens that I talked to, and I'm sure the old Steelers are the same. That's the games they remember. That is the games they remember. So I was talking to Kelly Gregg, an old defensive lineman, little squatty guy that was, I'm sure the Steeler fans remember him. Great little nose tackle. And boy, he remembers battling Alan Panica like nobody's business, just down in the mud, you know, just, you know, and these guys all have memories like that. So it's just classic football. And I think that's what people like about it.
Yeah, just a tremendous rivalry. You know, maybe if you could tell folks where they can read your items that are on the Ravens, that you said you're doing that a couple times a week.
Yeah.
Some things, if you give that address out, I appreciate
sure.
it.
Sure. Well, that's www.baltimoreravens.com. It's their website. I mean, my opinion's on there. There's a column on Tuesday. There's a column on Saturday. And within 2 hours of the game being over, my opinion's on whatever game is just taking place. So that's my gig these days. And, you know, just, so it's there. And of course it's, you know, they put it all stuff on social media. So it's all over the place, you know, NFL team website, there's a lot of traffic. So, but that's where I am these days.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time from your busy schedule and appreciate your knowledge of, you know, football's past, you know, going back into the beginnings of the NFL, right up and through the 50s and 60s with your books, and now writing about modern football on the Ravens website. And your, of course, your columns that you did back when you were still writing for the newspaper. So appreciate your well-rounded history and sharing information with us today and the stories of these great Dallas teams and franchises in that history. And appreciate you being on.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thanks. I enjoyed it. And yeah, I love it. I love writing about the history. It's fun stuff. And, you know, I find that a lot of people can relate to it. These Dallas books that I wrote, I've heard from a lot of non-Dallas football fans. So they're just sort of, it's all sort of eternal, right? I mean, it transfers. If you're a fan of some team, you're an old football fan, you like this stuff. So it's my pleasure to do it, really. It's a labor of love.
I can testify to that because I'm not a big fan of either team, but I found the book extremely interesting because of the history and the great story that you had and the stories within the story. Just fascinating, well done, and much appreciated. So, and appreciate you being on here today too. So thank you, John.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, it's found right here on the Sports History Network.